We'll go ahead and call the meeting to order, the meeting of the Finance and Facilities Subcommittee for this morning. Members, Cheryl, please call the roll to get us started. Members, please turn on your mic when you answer for roll call.
Chair Yarborough.
Here.
Representatives Beltran, Benjamin, Batana.
Here.
Bissada Cabrera.
Here.
Caruso.
Here.
Taney.
Here.
Duran.
Here.
Fabricio.
Here.
Hantovsky.
Here.
Joseph.
Here.
Mello.
Here.
Mooney.
Here.
Morales is excused. Persons Milica.
Here.
Sabatini is excused. Tant.
Here.
Williamson is excused. A quorum is present.
Thank you, Cheryl. And members, good morning. I wanted to mention, too, we have a few visiting members who are with us. Rep. Garrison, thank you for being with us this morning, and also Rep. Bell. Thank you, and I think those are all the visiting members, and certainly any can come in as we discuss the topic this morning. So, members, again, good morning. Today, we will be conducting a workshop on insulin insurance costs. We have a panel today with us. We appreciate all the panel members joining us this morning for this important discussion. We have, and each one will have a few minutes to introduce themselves here shortly, but just to introduce them, we have Ms. Anastasia Albanese O'Neill, PhD, also an APRN. We appreciate you being with us this morning. Mr. Chris Clark, endurance athlete and type 1 diabetic with us here this morning. Audrey Brown, Florida Association of Health Plans, thank you for being here. And Mike Jones, president of Molina Healthcare, thank you for being here this morning. So what we'll do, members, is begin by allowing a few minutes for each panelist to make a statement, followed by member questions and discussions. And then we did have one appearance card that was turned in, so if we have time near the end, then we will allow for that public testimony if the speaker would like to do that. And so we will go ahead and get started. Ms. Albanese O'Neill, Dr. Albanese O'Neill, excuse me, if you would like to begin, we'll give you a few minutes to give an introduction.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I didn't know if there was a button I needed to push. I want to thank Chairman Yarborough and the other distinguished members of the committee for the opportunity to be here today. I am grateful to Representative Bell, who is also here, for sponsoring House Bill 109, which would cap insulin copays at $100. This is an important piece of legislation for Floridians living with diabetes. Nearly 2 million people in our state have diagnosed diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, and that comprises of almost 12% of the state's population, so 1 in 10 at least. Some of these people with type 2 diabetes and all of Floridians living with type 1 diabetes rely on insulin to stay alive. I hold a PhD in nursing science, and I'm a board-certified pediatric nurse practitioner and certified diabetes care and education specialist by training. My clinical practice has focused on caring for children, adolescents, and young adults with type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes, as many of you know, is an autoimmune condition in which the body's immune system mistakenly attacks and destroys the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas, and the person is no longer able to produce insulin. Insulin is a hormone necessary to sustain life. It acts like a key that unlocks the cells so the body's fuel, glucose, we're all familiar with blood sugar, can enter. People with type 1 diabetes must replace insulin with multiple daily injections or use an insulin pump to stay alive. And at this time, there is no cure. Insulin for people with type 1 diabetes is not an optional medication. As you are no doubt aware, the rising cost of prescription drugs has created an outsized burden for everyday Americans from all walks of life. But for people with diabetes, many of whom rely on medications like insulin, this financial barrier can mean the difference between life and death. The price of insulin alone has roughly tripled in the past decade, increasing from less than $100 for an average vial in 2009 to nearly $300 for the same vial today, even though the cost to produce a vial of most analog insulins is between $3.69 and $6.16. And these insulins are nearly the exact same product as they were 10 and even 20 years ago. And I can say that with some confidence because my daughter has been taking the same insulin since she was diagnosed with diabetes in 2002. People with type 1 diabetes often require multiple vials of insulin every month. Some people with diabetes are cutting back or skipping doses of insulin or forgoing other necessities to pay for insulin, which puts their lives and their health at risk. Let me provide you with an example from my clinical practice. I had the privilege of providing care for a lovely young woman who was diagnosed with diabetes type 1 at the age of 3. Since her diagnosis in 1991, she and her parents meticulously managed her disease, and she never returned to the hospital after her diagnosis at 3. She was an excellent student and was earning her undergraduate degree at the University of Florida when she came into my care. Her parents were both professionals with access to employer-provided health care. And in 2009, when she was 21 years old and a senior at the University of Florida, she was hospitalized for an acute complication of diabetes called diabetic ketoacidosis, which is life-threatening and occurs in type 1 diabetes when a person does not have enough insulin. Again, without insulin, the body cannot use glucose for fuel, and metabolic changes occur very quickly in a matter of days, and the person is at risk for coma and death if we don't immediately address it in the emergency room or ICU. I met with my patient in clinic a week after her hospitalization. This is a 21-year-old. She looked very sad. She didn't meet my eyes like she usually did. She said the hospital stay had been frightening. She hadn't been back in the hospital before she could remember as a 3-year-old. She said she was very sick by the time she sought care in the emergency room. And for the first time, she explained that both of her parents had lost their jobs in the recession of 2008. At 21, she wasn't eligible for Medicaid. So after COBRA had run out and she had exhausted her UF student health insurance, she started rationing insulin, and this led to her hospitalization. I asked her why she hadn't reached out to us for help. We had a great relationship. And she said she had been so overwhelmed by the cost of her medications, she didn't want to trouble anyone, and she was ashamed. We were able to ensure access to insulin through donations for the remainder of her senior year. She graduated, obtained an excellent job with insurance. I often think about the personal trauma she experienced. She was never hospitalized until this stay. But I also reflect on the preventable cost of that hospital stay, which was tens of thousands of dollars. Until she was forced to ration her insulin, she had never been hospitalized for her diabetes. This was in 2009, and unfortunately, this is still happening. If we fast forward to 2021 today, Americans are spending more to treat diabetes than any other chronic diagnosis. 1 in 4 insulin-requiring Americans reports that they ration their insulin, 1 in 4, which leads to downstream costs. A survey by the American Diabetes Association found that 30% report to having to choose between insulin and their utilities, 27% between choosing for insulin and housing, 26% say they take less insulin than their doctor asked them or required them to, and 23% say they miss doses weekly because they can't afford it. As I've already mentioned, if you ration insulin and skip doses, it's unsafe. It can lead to costly and preventable emergency room and hospital visits, much like what happened to my patient all those years ago. And I want to underline that rationing insulin can be deadly. House Bill 109, puts the interests of Floridians first. It prioritizes people in Florida who live with diabetes. When they show up at the pharmacy counter, they will know each month when they pick up their insulin prescription that the copay price will be the same. There will not be any surprises. They can budget and save for this expenditure. And this practical approach, again, puts them first. Finally, I mentioned earlier in full disclosure that I have a daughter who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at the age of 16 months in 2002. April 27th, later this month, will mark the 19th anniversary of her diagnosis. She is a 20-year-old sophomore at the University of Florida. She was valedictorian of her high school class with an unweighted GPA of 4.0 and a weighted GPA of 4.95. She's an honors student at UF. She's a STAMP scholar, so she has a special scholarship granted to only 11 UF students annually. She's also a Graham Center Fellow, a member of the Luminaries, and was recently invited to be a member of Phi Beta Kappa. While it certainly feels good to share her accomplishments with you, I am doing so as prelude to what I am going to say next. When we talk about her future career options, it's not a conversation about her hopes or her talents or the risk she plans to take as an entrepreneur or a business owner in the state of Florida that she might one day build. She is single-mindedly focused on what career will give her secure access to insurance that covers her insulin costs and her other diabetes supplies. As a parent, I desperately want to tell her to throw caution to the wind. And I want her to pursue her dreams and to take risks as a 20 or 21-year-old. But as a mother who is also a healthcare professional, I know that giving her this advice would be irresponsible, possibly reckless, and certainly dangerous. So with some sadness, I help her strategize about her future and pray that I'm not contributing to a dream deferred. Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm happy to answer any questions. And as a parent and healthcare professional, thank you for taking the opportunity to put Floridians first.
Dr. Albanese O'Neill, thank you. We appreciate your opening remarks. Thank you for being here with us today. Mr. Clark, you're recognized for an introduction.
Good morning, and thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, everybody, for being here. And thank you for, as Anastasia just said, taking the time to put Floridians first. A lot of what you heard from her, I can speak to personally. I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes June 9th, 2003. My blood glucose level at the time was 1,180. If you're familiar with diabetes, you know how extremely high that was. It's amazing that I was alive. In fact, at the time, I had the highest blood glucose level of anybody diagnosed with diabetes at that hospital who wasn't either in a coma or dead. So lucky me, I'm here to speak to you about the cost of insulin. So I was diagnosed June 9th, 2003. Over the course of about 5 years after my diagnosis, my health took a long, slow downward spiral in which I did many of the things that you've heard from other people, either friends, or as Anastasia just said, you know, I rationed my insulin, I cut back, I did anything I could to keep the payment, to keep me alive within an amount that I could, in fact, pay my rent, pay for groceries, all, you know, car insurance, all that fun stuff. After about 5 years, my health had deteriorated so much that I spent the latter part of 2008, all of 2009, and the first 7 months of 2010 sick in bed. When I say sick in bed, I mean I would get up to use the restroom if I was physically able to do it. If. In July of 2010, I actually learned of a couple type 1 diabetic athletes coming to speak at the hospital where I was living at the time. I had secluded myself, isolated myself. I didn't speak to my family very much, my friends. My mom would call and say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I'm sick, I'm busy. You know, very easy to isolate yourself at that age. You know, everybody's thinking that you're career bound, which I was, but there was a big cloud over everything that I was doing in my life, and that was my diabetes management. My diabetes management had gotten so bad that I was taking regular insulin and NPH, which is a very, very generic kind of insulin. I was rationing it, and at the time, because my health had gone so down so much and I wasn't working, I was on a dollar a day for food. A dollar a day. That's what I could afford to keep me alive. And you're wondering, like, how does one go on a dollar a day? Well, at the time, I could buy 5 boxes of mac and cheese for a dollar. That gave me a week's worth of mac and cheese. You combine that with some veggies or something. And again, as a type 1 diabetic, mac and cheese is probably not the best thing for you, even though I still eat it. Come on, it's mac and cheese, man. This is what I did to survive. That's what I did to keep myself alive so that I could be here today and speak to you about how hard it is. Now, I'm going to, you know, keep my testimony here pretty short because I want to give you plenty of time to ask questions. But I've testified in front of the Senate a couple of times, and the way I always described it was this. You hear about the exponential gains, you know, in cost to the consumer. Insulin has risen, I think, 1,200% since 2002, something like that, the cost. When I graduated, I got a job. I had health insurance. I've had health insurance. I've not had health insurance throughout my tenure as a diabetic. But on average, you can say that I've spent about $1,000 a month to keep myself alive. $1,000, that little vial of insulin that keeps me alive. Remember, if I don't take my insulin, I die. Her daughter, dead. It's not if, it's when. Might be a day, might be a week, but I'm dead. I'm not here speaking with you. So back to my story. I was diagnosed, spent about $1,000 a month. Fast forward 18 years. The first time I testified in front of the Senate committee, it was 179 months. It's $179,000 that has come out of my pocket to keep myself alive. Now I'm at, I think, $216,000 or $218,000. You heard about her daughter trying to figure out what career she wants to go in. I don't know what she's going to choose, but I know when she gets to be my age, having $216,000, $218,000 in her pocket is going to help her life. First time I testified, my wife came up after me and spoke about how we haven't started a family, how we don't own a home yet. People ask why. You can guess why. Because I pay money to keep myself alive. Again, I think that $218,000 would go pretty far towards starting a family, providing a house for that family. I'd very much like that, but I don't get that time back. And that's why I'm here, to plead to you my case and the case of every other diabetic, type 1 or type 2, and how you can help them. So again, I thank you so much for being here and for listening to me for a couple of minutes. I look forward to any questions that you guys have. Thank you.
Mr. Clark, thank you. We appreciate you being here this morning. Thank you for sharing your story with us. Next, we have Audrey Brown with the Florida Association of Health Plans. Ms. Brown, good morning. You're recognized to make some opening remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I really do appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. This is a very important issue. I thank Representative Bell for bringing this issue to light so that we could have this type of dialogue. I think we've heard a lot from the doctor and from an actual patient who has had to deal with this in their throughout their life, throughout their careers, and how important insulin is to their lives. So I do appreciate the opportunity. I do represent the Florida Association of Health Plans. We are the state trade association. We represent Medicaid, managed care, as well as the commercial insurance industry, Medicare Advantage plans as well. And health plans really are here to provide access to coordinated, comprehensive quality care to individuals and businesses, as well as government programs, as I mentioned, Medicaid and Medicare. And we're here to provide stability and value to the state and respect the taxpayer dollar, and we are your partners. But as health plans, we're really our responsibility is to help ensure our members take medically necessary medications that improve health outcomes and lower overall medical costs and improve their quality of life. Since drug price reductions by pharmaceutical manufacturers can help bring down costs, we are always in favor of that. But only a few drug companies ever reduce the cost of drugs. And so therefore, the health plans have to be there to negotiate. This is why health plans employ techniques to drive down costs to minimize price increases while staying focused on ensuring access to life-saving medications like insulin. We look to encourage the use of lower-cost alternatives like generic medications. We use evidence-based authorizations to ensure patients utilize medications according to clinical standards. And finally, obtain lower costs for drugs by using competition between manufacturers to promote one brand drug over another when there are more than one in a clinically equivalent drug class. When you hear from advocates that support eliminating these types of tools to try to keep drug prices affordable, you sometimes hear claims that healthcare decisions at the health plan level are made by bureaucrats sitting behind a desk, and they're more interested in cost over care. However, the truth is that all health plan formulary decisions are based upon medical evidence, including guidelines from the leading medical specialty societies, and are reviewed by panels of medical experts, and we call those pharmacy and therapeutics committees, or P&T committees. Health plans also employ medical doctors and pharmacy directors who are licensed in their medical fields to assist with exemption requests from providers or health plan members and other appeals. Plan members usually have a contractual right to appeal any decision and request other coverage if they need to do so, and their doctor is providing that medical advice that is, in fact, medically necessary for that patient. Drug manufacturers, on the contrary, fight the use of generics by promoting their drugs through physician marketing and direct-to-consumer marketing to advertise and build brand loyalty. Then they raise their drug prices. Use of direct-to-consumer advertising for branded drugs has risen exponentially in the last several years. I'm sure you've seen the commercials. The last total number I saw was about $5.5 billion on paid advertisement that you see on television. We don't often get a look into how drug manufacturers set their list price for their products. But last year in the Senate Banking and Insurance Committee, a drug manufacturer described in testimony when they set their list price, and I'm going to directly quote, "We look at the value that the product brings or the medicine brings to the patient. What are the improvements over the course of their life? And sometimes those medications are life-saving. So we factor that into the price that we set." Those were specific comments from a drug manufacturer on a panel before Senate Banking and Insurance. So after the manufacturer adds the research and development costs, marketing costs, and their profit, they sometimes increase their list price if the product is life-saving. And what we're talking about today is insulin, a life-saving drug. Well, this drug manufacturer is not one of the big three insulin drug makers. I think this is a glimpse into how list prices are created by drug manufacturers and may explain a lot about the cost increases that we have seen for insulin, since it is a drug that has been commercially available for almost 100 years. I believe it was created and first used in
Dr. Frederick Banting,
100 years ago. 1922, I think, is when this drug has been around for 100 years. Depending on the source, whether it is the Federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, the American Medical Association, American Diabetes Association, or various other sources, diabetes is now the most expensive chronic condition in the United States, affecting over 30 million Americans, with over 8 million Americans relying on insulin to treat their condition. Decades ago, health insurance did not always cover prescription drugs, but clearly the access to life-saving drugs like insulin are a critical component of comprehensive health care, which is why health plans include insulin drugs on their drug formularies and encourage medication adherence to help manage the condition and keep patients from having to have any adverse effects or even worse, death. Health plans provide for medically necessary services and medications to keep their members out of the emergency room and try to improve the quality of their lives. When we see proposals to cap the patient's out-of-pocket expense, it certainly is well-intended and we understand. Health insurers are constantly trying to balance the cost of health insurance to the plan sponsor or the employer or the individual paying that premium with the out-of-pocket cost of the patient, as the cost of drug prices, though, continue to increase. And if the premiums do go too high, the employers or the individual may choose to forego coverage or not offer that coverage to their employee, and that patient may forego having their own coverage. But what we all know is that is the worst thing that can happen, especially when people need access to life-saving drugs. What is not acknowledged, though, in a proposal just to cap a copay is that the list price all common types of insulin, and I know the doctor just referenced this, these prices for the same drug over the last decade have tripled. There are three drug manufacturers that control this market of insulin who have increased their prices in lockstep for several years and were the subject of a U.S. Senate Finance Committee bipartisan investigation and found that these insulin drug companies aggressively raised the list price absent significant advances in efficacy of the drug. It's the same drug. The average list price of insulin increased 11% annually from 2001 to 2018. One in every four U.S. healthcare dollars spent on someone with diabetes is spent on someone with diabetes, and one in $7 spent directly on some diabetes-related care. Health insurers are constantly trying to control these costs without creating barriers to patients in obtaining their essential drugs like insulin. Insurers do not view drugs as profitable. They view them as an integral component to to overall health care and taking care of a person holistically. Mike Jones, the CEO of Molina, will talk about what insurers are doing specifically on programs like using preventive drug lists that have a zero copay for drugs like insulin, or sending any brand insulin drug rebates directly to the patient to offset their patient copay when they fill their insulin. These programs are working and minimizing patient costs for many, but there are still patients who don't have those options, and I know that's one of the focuses for you all. There's really still much work to do. There's examples that I could give you of companies and health plans that are doing different things with direct-to-patient rebates or flat co-payments, no application to a deductible. But again, there's still work to be done there, and I know that the plans are very concerned about this very issue. And finally, I just wanted to point out, I mean, as you are the state's policymakers, we are here as your partners to suggest ways to help patients and offer options for your consideration as you talk about serious issues like this. One such option, other than to legislate benefit design options that limit product choice or new regulation on insurers, is to pursue drug price transparency and notice to the legislature, to the regulators of the state of Florida, especially for those drug manufacturers that benefit from being on the state group plan formulary or Medicaid. They're taking money from the state, and they are not apprising you all of these cost increases. And I think if transparency was there, they might shed some more light on the cost going up and actually help for you all to make your decisions in planning for the future of your state budget, but also shine the light, put some light and transparency on insulin drug manufacturers and their cost increases that are continuing to go up. So with that, I will be happy to answer any questions and turn my time over to Mr. Jones. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. We appreciate you being with us this morning. Thank you very much. And our final panelist, Mike Jones, president of Molina Healthcare. Mr. Jones, good morning. Thank you for being here. You're recognized to give some remarks.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and esteemed members of the committee. As the chairman said, my name is Mike Jones. I'm the president and CEO of Molina Healthcare of Florida. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about the rising insulin prices and the impact that it has on our members managing their diabetes and other chronic conditions. As president of Molina Healthcare Florida, I am responsible for the operations and delivery of quality healthcare to over 175,000 Medicaid, Medicare, and marketplace exchange beneficiaries across the state of Florida. I also serve as the chair of the Florida Association of Health Plans Commercial Insurance Committee. Managed care organizations like Molina Healthcare play an important role in coordinating healthcare for millions of Floridians. We help to connect beneficiaries to resources, education, and access to healthcare professionals to help people manage their health. As the leader of a managed care organization, my primary goal was to help drive better health outcomes, which ultimately will lower the overall cost of care. One way we drive better health outcomes and control medical costs is by managing a beneficiary's chronic conditions, like diabetes. For example, we leverage disease management programs to outreach to diabetic members and provide them general education and information about their disease, as well as how to manage it, what diets to follow, and what testing to complete each year. Members who seem to have a harder time keeping their diabetes managed, ending up in the ER or with lab tests outside of normal range, are enrolled in case management programs where we assign a trained case manager who works with the member and also their treating physician to help take the necessary steps to improve the control of the member's diabetes or diabetic condition. This can include adjusting the member's medication, getting additional screening tests completed in a timely fashion, or education about lifestyle changes, and assisting with community resources to help overcome barriers like food insecurity or other social determinants of health that may be contributing to their difficulty in managing their diabetic condition. Specific to diabetes, these programs help prevent more than 480,000 heart failures, 230,000 cases of kidney disease, 180,000 strokes, and 8,000 amputations every year across our country. One challenge we often see is with non-compliant diabetic members is the ability of the member to afford their insulin medications. In these situations, we work with the member's physician to explore opportunities in changing the member's medication regimen, dosage, frequency, or look for other lower drug tier alternatives in hopes of helping to ultimately reduce their out-of-pocket costs. Access to affordable, life-saving medications like insulin is critical to helping members manage their health and chronic conditions. As a health plan, we have little control over the cost of medications like insulin, and we work to negotiate with discounts when possible, but currently the insulin market is consolidated, hindering competition and limiting alternatives, leading to higher list prices on new and existing brand insulins. As Audrey said, from a benefit design perspective, the out-of-pocket cost that a member pays for insulin directly correlates to the price drug makers charge for the medication. We price our products and cost sharing based on medical and pharmacy costs and projected utilization. We do not price our cost sharing to drive profitability. In closing, health insurers are in the business of prevention and treatment of chronic conditions in hopes of avoiding a larger, more costlier episode of care. We do not design plan cost sharing or co-pays with the idea of driving profitability in mind. Access to affordable, life-sustaining medication like insulin is crucial to management and treatment of chronic conditions. Capping co-pays or co-insurance doesn't really help us solve the problem. If we really want to do something about the problem, I believe we have to go to the source and address skyrocketing costs of the drugs themselves if we truly want to make a meaningful impact on the people that rely on these drugs for everyday life. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak to you today.
Mr. Jones, thank you. We appreciate your remarks. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. And again, to all the panelists for coming this morning. So members will now open up for questions. And what I'd like to do, I know with this being a very important topic, we probably have a number of questions. So let's start with two each, and then we can certainly go back and do more. That way we give any member that would like to the opportunity to ask questions. And if you can, to the extent possible, try to direct the question to a particular panelist. If it's a general question, then that's okay too. But if you have a specific one for one of them, then try to direct that so we can be prudent about our use of time. And again, Rep. Bell, we appreciate you being with us this morning. I'll give you an opportunity if you'd like. I know the subject is very important, and we've talked extensively about it. You don't have to, but if you have any initial questions, you're certainly welcome to do that to begin with.
Well, I would just like to thank Chair Yarbrough for allowing us to workshop this morning. It's so important to me. When I ran 3 years ago, this was something that I was going to run on was the insulin bill. My daughter, which is 36 years old, is a type 1 diabetic. She was diagnosed at 26 years old over in Italy. Actually, she was traveling and kept getting sicker and sicker, and they were treating her for food poisoning and giving her more and more carbs, and she went into kidney failure and was hospitalized over there, and we brought her back. And so within the first 5 years, she was like the Chris there that, you know, was kind of embarrassed, didn't want to come out with it, but now she has educated herself and has started a support group in our county and has over 150 families in the support group that have type 1 diabetic children. Can you imagine at 10 o'clock at night, you have a 3-year-old that becomes lethargic and you take them to the hospital and they say, well, your child's a diabetic and you're sent home with all these insulin drugs or prescriptions to go get them, and it's costing you $800 to $1,500 a month so that your child will survive, because they could only one day to 5 days and then their life is gone. So, and these families are having to deal with this, our Florida citizens. And so that is just my statement that I wanted to give this morning of why I'm so passionate about trying to work with our panel here and coming, you know, the dialogue, just getting it started, because I know that, you know, it's not a solution to cap the insurance companies, and that's not what I want to do. And the real problem is, like Mr. Jones said, is the pharmaceutical companies that is gouging. My daughter can go to Canada and get a vial of insulin for $30 that she pays $265 here for. we're very fortunate that we can't, that she's able to afford it, but there's many families out there that cannot, and like you said, they're rationing their insulin. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bell. Thank you. Thank you again for being with us this morning. So members, we'll open it up for questions. Rep. Hunchofsky, I saw your hand first, so go ahead. You're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Bell, for sharing your story. I have several friends whose children have type 1 diabetes, and I know how difficult it is. I know how difficult it is, especially during the teenage years. There's a lot of embarrassment, and then there's a lot of hormonal changes making it very difficult. Representative Bell just talked about the difference between the pricing in our country and in Canada. Would somebody be able to explain why we have such a difference between the cost in this country and the cost in other countries? And I would just add to that, we've talked about people with health insurance, but we have so many Americans that have no health insurance. So when we do discuss this, I appreciate when we're talking about those who have it and also those who don't have it. So if somebody could just address where that discrepancy is coming from in pricing between our country and other countries.
And I'm sorry, I don't know the reasons why.
Ms. Brown, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know exactly the reasons why the cost of drugs in other countries is so much cheaper, but I think the doctor down here appears to know.
Yeah.
Dr. Albanese, you're recognized. Any questions are fine. Let's just make sure we go through the chair, but you're recognized. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. The United States is the only high-income country that doesn't have a national healthcare system. And that may be a political statement or not, but it's a fact. And because of that, other countries can negotiate lower prices overall, like our partners in health insurance try to do with the insulin companies on an individual level. I will tell you that the majority of profits for insulin makers come from the United States. They sell insulin at a significantly lower price in other countries. When my daughter had trouble with her devices, her insulin pump in Mexico, she was able to buy insulin at the Costco in Mexico for $50 a vial, where she would have paid $300 here. So other countries have negotiated overall lower prices. The bulk of profits for insulin manufacturers come from the United States, as high as 60% globally. So most of the profit is coming here because prices are higher. I know that a copay cap isn't a perfect solution, but I want to share with you a story of one of my patients, another patient. There were five children in the family, and their 8-year-old had type 1 diabetes. And this family came in early one December, and the kids left the room with mom, and dad said, please don't bring up Christmas. And I said, okay, I won't. And I said, but can I ask why? And he said, we're saving because we have to meet our deductible. Because in January, our deductible resets, and we cannot spend money on gifts because we have to save it to buy insulin in January, because we will pay everything out of pocket based on our current plan. And then eventually later in the year, we'll meet our deductible and we'll pay very little. But because they couldn't have an affordable set price in January, they ended up paying more all year. In the end, they paid the same. But it was an extraordinary burden for that family to have to meet all of that deductible for 1 month's supply, 3 vials at $900 of insulin, and then that second month in February. So something that puts the patient first, anything that moves us toward putting the patient first, is helpful. And that's why the American Diabetes Association and other organizations and clinicians are supporting this effort, because it puts people living with diabetes first. And I hope I answered your first question adequately.
Ms. Brown, would you like to respond as well?
Absolutely. I think what we are all hearing is the importance of this drug, and who is missing from this table who could answer your question, Representative, are the manufacturers. They're not here to explain. What you would hear from them, and we've heard, is that they have to go through Federal Drug Administration. They have research and development costs. It's so expensive for them to develop these drugs. That's why in America, because we have all this regulation over them to do the R&D and to get the approval from the FDA and these patents, that's what they would say. But I can't speak for them, and they're not here to answer why in America drugs cost so much more than other countries.
Thank you. Mr. Clark, did you just briefly?
Yes, sir, if you don't mind. I'd like to say a couple things that touch on what you've just heard. It was said the difference between insulin here in the U.S. and Canada. I know that was one example. I have a friend that just left Canada. She's a microbiologist, just finished her, her rounds or whatever, moved to Glasgow, Scotland. And she posted a huge thing recently on social media blasting the Canadian government for how much they had to spend to keep themselves alive, because it cost over $100 a month for them, for all of their diabetes supply, you know, not just insulin, but you know, tester strips and everything. $100 a month. Couldn't believe it. In Glasgow, they walked in. Europe has a much different system, not saying it's better or worse, but for diabetics, she walked into the pharmacy, they gave her everything that she needed for a month, didn't even hand her a receipt, just said, have a great day. I don't see that happening here. You've heard all these testimonies about how people are rationing and doing things, and yet in other places, they're just told, enjoy your life, do something. Now, it was also said earlier, this is more to my point, that insulin was discovered in 1921 by Dr. Frederick Banting. He sold the patent to the University of Toronto for $1 because he said that nobody should profit from insulin, belong to the people. There are three major manufacturers in this world right now that manufacture insulin. And the reason that they still have hold of the patents and no generics have been able to be developed, best way I can put it to people, and please, I'm not a medical scientist or anything. I'm an endurance athlete. I just swim, bike, and run a lot. But if you take the DNA of insulin and then you just move like one thing, it basically doesn't change the insulin a whole lot, but according to its code does, guess what? You get a whole new patent. So for the rest of humanity, and as long as this earth and our laws are still the same, they can just make little tweaks, however, you know, 48 years into the thing, and just continue their patent. And generic stuff will never be able to be developed. So that's, just wanted to pass those couple of things on to give you some, you know, point of reference for what many of us know. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Botana, you recognize next for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate it. And this is a general question. Is there any review of price of insulin by state regulators? Is there any review along those lines? And then is this just like, I don't have anybody in my family that has diabetes. My mom's extremely allergic to bees. So when she has, you know, she gets stung, it's not one EpiPen, it's two. So you're talking $700, you know. So is this just, you know, just elaborate, and is there any state regulators on this?
Who'd like to take that one?
I can, Mr.
Ms. Brown, go ahead.
Actually, in the state of Florida, if you look at drug prices, the state Medicaid program, the Agency for Healthcare Administration, negotiates with the pharmaceutical manufacturers to establish a preferred drug list for Medicaid. And Medicaid is at no cost to the Medicaid recipient. But the state is certainly paying those costs. So there is a negotiation that goes on between the agency and the manufacturers so that there are drugs on these formularies and access to those drugs. But there is no regulator that actually gets to truly see or set price or help set prices or has oversight of the prices that Big Pharma sets for these drugs. And as you've mentioned, EpiPen, Representative, we saw a 600%.
Pull the mic a little closer.
We saw a 600% increase in the cost of that of the EpiPen in a year. And there was no reason, rationale given, other than I think there was a competitor coming to market. And so they wanted to make the most money they could before that competitor came to market. What our thought process has been, and I know last year before this legislature, Representative Andrade had a bill that included a pharmaceutical price transparency component to allow you, the policymakers, to allow the state regulators, the insurance commissioner, the agency, and you to at least get notice of, in advance, increases to the cost of drugs at a certain level, if they were going to raise the price 20%, 25%, whatever that is. And those types of bills have been introduced and passed in other states. So I just put that out there again as, no, sir, there is really no regulation over the prices that continue to rise, other than the tools that we have as insurers trying to negotiate the best price possible. But who sets the price for the drug? The manufacturer.
I'd also...
Thank you. Dr. Albanese, brief response. Go ahead.
Sure, if that's okay. I just wanted to add that I think there are a lot of players along the insulin supply chain. And I think certainly we need to advocate for increased transparency throughout that supply chain about where the profit-taking is occurring, not just with the manufacturers. This includes shedding light on practices and accountability in the pharmacy benefit managers group, which is sort of a quiet partner in this process, and ensure that rebates benefit patients. Often they're held at the pharmacy and don't go directly to the patient, which also artificially increases prices. A clinical example is there is a component of the glucose monitor. I know it's not insulin, but it's the transmitter. And this transmitter can be as high as $500 per transmitter. It lasts for 3 months. But Costco, sorry, Costco keeps coming up. I do not own stock in Costco, but Costco offers, always passes along their rebates to the member. And so one day in clinic, we started getting phone call after phone call saying, please prescribe my transmitters to Costco because they were passing them along at cost. They were passing along that rebate at cost to the patient. Other DME companies and pharmacies were not, and they were getting those transmitters for $44. And as long as that rebate was offered, they passed it along to the customer. I cannot tell you how many prescriptions and how many new members became Costco members during that time because their cost was so significantly lower. So it's not just manufacturers. It's all along the supply chain of pharmaceuticals and medical devices. And I think we need more transparency, and I think we do need to speed sort of competitive generic drugs and biosimilars, as Chris mentioned. But I wanted to say that I think it's a very complicated, again, to your question, if it's a very complicated system, transparency would be helpful.
Dr. O'Neill, thank you. We have several more members who have questions, so I just want to move along. Thank you for the response, that we appreciate it. Rep. Fabricio, you're recognized next for a question.
Thank you, Chair. I, like Rep. Botana, don't have a lot of direct contact with diabetes, but there is no question in my mind that the problem exists, because your presentations are two parts, right? That we have a problem, and I agree, we have a problem. It's a huge growing number of persons with diabetes, and the cost of the insulin is very high, shockingly high. And I agree that we need more transparency. My concern comes in with regard to how we're going to shift that cost and what we're going to do to resolve that problem. So we agree there's a problem. We agree that a problem needs to be resolved. And the question is, how do we resolve that problem in a sustainable, equitable way for all the folks that need to have this problem resolved? And one question first, and you may have mentioned it, and I'm sorry if I missed it, Ms. Brown. It seems that if there is a situation where the pharmaceutical manufacturers are charging X dollars, and that X can grow over time as it has been, and you are capped at a certain amount that you're able to charge the policyholder, it seems that there is going to be an increase in premium at some time. Is that correct?
Ms. Brown, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look at it as a cost shift, right? So if we don't charge anything for a copay or no deductible for any drug, certainly that's up to the policymakers to tell the plans that that's what you would like us to do. But at the same time, that's not really going to do anything about the underlying problem. It's just a mask to the fact that the prices are still going to go up for the drug itself. And so the health plan is going to still be paying the higher price. There'll be no cost to the patient. And that, again, is a policy decision to be made. But without without any out-of-pocket, then it's really just a cost shift and premiums for employers and for individuals who are purchasing health insurance. Yes, that will be impacted and potentially rise and increase the cost of those premiums.
Quick follow-up, Fabrizio, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. I look at it from a perspective of trying to make this a sustainable policy solution that will work ultimately for everyone. I think Mr. Clark?
Yes.
Mentioned that there are some intellectual property barriers into the market. I'm not an intellectual property attorney. I don't know what the patent restrictions are on some of these issues, but Ms. Brown, would you agree or comment on whether at other levels of legislation, if changes were made with regard to intellectual property, with regard to this insulin, that would help reduce barriers to the market and that would bring more insulin manufacturers that could bring down the price of the medication?
Ms. Brown, if you could pull the mic a little closer,
yes,
too.
Thank you.
Certainly,
Representative, competition is better. Competition will drive costs down. There's been a lot of work done at the federal level. Congress, as well as the SEC, have looked at some of the activities by drug manufacturers and how they are preventing competition from coming to the market by even purchasing companies that are about to, you know, be granted their patent. The big companies can just purchase the one that was going to become the competitor, and they no longer have a competitor. But those two things are, I think, at the federal level, and I'm not sure, and haven't explored, and we certainly can, what could be done at the state level. What I've seen in other states to try to address these types of issues is to truly just get more transparency in terms of reporting to policymakers or the regulators of the state, especially those that participate in, use taxpayer dollars, receive taxpayer dollars for medication. Those types of proposals may shed some light on what's going on with price increases, and I'm not sure intellectual property-wise or not what can be done at the state level. I would look to our state policymakers to take a look at what could be done. But I know at the federal level, there's a lot of look, and the state's attorneys general across the country have been looking at some of these types of activities in terms of preventing competition from coming into the market, and obviously what we would prefer in any industry, right, to drive down the cost and improve quality is to have competition.
Thank you. Dr. O'Neill, would you like to make a comment on that?
If I could just briefly share some data, there have been 15 states that have passed copay caps, and including our southern neighbors in Virginia, West Virginia, and Kentucky. The Kentucky bill was passed most recently on March 22nd of this year. Their analysis showed that the premium increase would be as little as 7 cents to 24 cents per individual per month. In Washington state, which passed a copay cap earlier, which was very similar to the proposal here in Florida, House Bill 109 in March of 2020. After that bill passed, 15 health insurers filed an average proposed rate decrease of 1.79% for the 2021 individual healthcare insurance market. So we haven't seen a dramatic rise in these 15 states in premium costs. Certainly the cost has to be absorbed somewhere, but that hasn't redounded back to premiums in any significant way. And I'm happy to share these data with the committee by email following today's meeting.
Thank you, Doctor. We appreciate that. Vice Chair Caruso moves we extend the meeting by 15 minutes to 10:15. Without objection, we will show that motion adopted. Next, we'll have Representative Garrison for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for allowing me to sit in today, and for members of the committee. Just this is very personal for me, and Doctor and I have met each other many functions over the years. My daughter was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes a week before her 9th birthday. She's 100% insulin dependent and will be for the rest of her life until we have a cure. So I appreciate this, and it's a part of my reason for running is to be a voice not just for the folks with type 1 diabetes, but also for parents with kids who are 100% dependent for their life on medications such as this. I'm piggybacking on my good friend Representative Fabricio's question. As a policymaker and also a dad whose daughter needs insulin to live, I'm struck by sometimes talk about the lack of competition in the marketplace. And I guess my question is to the panel as a whole, in addition to the intellectual property barriers that Representative Fabricio brought forward, are there any other inhibitors that folks specifically who are in the professional sphere on this see that are inhibiting competition and preventing the competition between insulin providers to compete on price? Since insulin is insulin, as we stated here, it's been around for 100 years, and the insulin that Jane gets every month, coming in her monthly supply, is basically the same insulin that folks were getting 50 years ago. As someone who believes in markets, there seems like there's a market breakdown somewhere. And I'm trying to understand as a policymaker where that market breakdown is. And so it's an open question to the floor. And thank you, Ms. Chair.
Thank you. Who would like to respond to that? Dr. Albany?
Chair, I can give it a try. You ask a really difficult question because the pharmaceutical supply chain is complicated. Insulin is a biologic, which means that we don't produce generics. We produce biosimilar drugs, which the prices of biosimilars tend to be about 85% of the patented drug. So you see a drug like Admelog, which would be a biosimilar drug to an already existing insulin. But as I stated in my remarks, some of these insulins have been around for 20 years, and certainly the research and development costs have been recovered at $300 a vial. I think the cost of producing a vial of an analog insulin, probably what your daughter takes, is between $3 and $7 now. And if we assume over the past, even for the first 15 years, that R&D and the other costs were recovered by the pharmaceutical company, we need to have more transparency in pricing. And there are similar drugs that have been out for the similar number of years. Every year we get new insulins. We have now, when I first started working in diabetes, I transitioned from a career in the airlines. There were only really two. Now there are six or seven, and they keep coming out. So we need more transparency to understand the pricing, the cost to industry, and really all of those pieces along the supply chain. And we need to do it at the state and federal level. But I think having hearings like this to discuss the realities of insulin costs are essential, and we need to keep having this conversation. So that's why I'm so grateful to be here today. And I'd be happy to provide in writing some additional information on some specifics, if that would be helpful to the committee. Because I could spend about a couple of hours talking about supply chain and manufacturing.
And we would, you've mentioned that a couple of times. We would welcome any additional information you'd like to send, Dr. O'Neill. That'd be fine.
Yes, sir.
If you'd like to
Thank
send
you.
It to our staff, they can distribute it to the committee. That'd be fine. Thank you. Thank you, Rep. Garrison. Representative Busada Cabrera, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I know we've talked a little bit about state agencies throughout today's hearing. Have there been any state agencies who have done any sort of study on why the insulin prices are so high and continue to increase?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware that there has been a specific study done. I know I've looked at drug prices and pharmacy benefit managers and things like that. There are always ongoing audits of those types of things, whether it's state group or Medicaid. But I have not seen anything specific, and maybe you all, your staff could share with you if there has been anything to really take a look at the cost of drugs and how those drug prices are continuing to climb.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Cheney, you were next. Go ahead for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Mr. Jones. I believe I heard that the cost to manufacture insulin is between $3 and $7, yet it's being sold to a patient for $300, and that what is in between that price gap is primarily PBMs. Would that be an accurate statement, or would you like to speak to that?
Mr. Jones, you're recognized.
Representative, I don't know that I could speak intelligently to it. I work on the health plan side. As the good doctor on the end mentioned earlier, this is very, very complicated. The system is very, very complicated, and I don't profess to fully understand everything that goes into drug pricing or things like that. However, I will say that there is a direct correlation between the cost of the medications and how we design plans and plan benefits. And so the physician at the end made a comment earlier about in other states where they've capped copays, they've seen a very nominal increase in premiums. And while factually that might be true, I think one of the things to keep in mind is it still doesn't do anything to address the cost. And while you might not see an overall increase in premium, it's like moving air in a balloon. It's going to go someplace else unless you address the cost. And so while the premiums might not have been increased, you may see a cost shift in other areas. So you could see a cost shift in either higher copays for other drugs, other services, higher or a greater share of co-insurance as a result of shifting the cost. But some way, I think what I'm trying to say is that unless you address the overall cost, at the end of the day, you can cap one area, you could cap insulin, but then the burden of cost-sharing responsibility is going to manifest itself to the beneficiary in another way. Might not be in premium increase, but I think it's going to manifest itself in other ways. Copays, co-insurance, things of that sort. Deductibles.
Your follow-up, Representative Cheney, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Jones, you mentioned that we need to address the cost of drugs. You made that as a statement. How do you propose we do that as a state?
Go ahead, Mr. Jones.
As it relates specifically to insulin, and Representative, you made a comment earlier. You said that the cost to produce insulin is between $3 and $7. It's being sold for $300. I think I would start right there and ask why. Why is the markup, I can't even do the math in my head. It's a ridiculous amount from a percentage standpoint. But if it's costing a manufacturer $3 to $7 to manufacture the drug and it's being sold for $300 and people's lives depend on this, I'd probably start right there.
Thank you. Okay, we have time for a few more questions. Ranking Member Joseph, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To answer Representative Basada Cabrera's question, there have been several studies done. I'm not aware of any by the Florida legislature, but at the federal level have been studies done, and lots of organizations have done plenty of studies on that particular issue. My question for the panel, I guess maybe starting with Mr. Jones and then with our esteemed doctor. So, you know, you started touching on some of the ancillary issues that come with failing to control insulin costs and regulate it in a way that's beneficial for the people of Florida. And I wanted to unpackage that a little bit because you alluded to it, and I thank you for the empirical stories that you shared with us, the anecdotal stories, but I want to unpackage it on a larger scale so that my colleagues fully grasp what our failure to act in this arena means to the people of Florida. You know, the old anecdote goes, when America catches a cold, Black America, you know, catches pneumonia. So this is something that disproportionately impacts communities of color, not just Black people, but Hispanic people as well. And anybody who has issues with some of the social determinants of health that you started talking about a moment ago. So if you could, for the benefit of the committee, unpackage what a failure to act looks like. What are some of the, so obviously the worst case scenario is death, but there's a lot of things in between that are ultimately cost borne by the state, which I think you referenced a little bit. So if you could unpackage that for us, that would be helpful.
Mr. Jones, go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for the question. I'm in the business of health insurance. And so we focus a lot on programs and things like that, you know, ideally with the intent on driving health outcomes. And when you drive good health outcomes, that that usually manifests itself in a lower overall cost of care to the company, cost of care to the patient, cost of care to the state.
Mr. Jones, I'm sorry, pull the microphone.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, there again. Thank you.
So when you talk about, let's say, diabetics not taking their insulin, and I think the doctor in the end actually provided a very real-life example, or Chris provided a very real-life example of the cost of not maintaining their medication regimen, or the cost of not staying ahead or managing their diabetes. And the cost is it manifests itself in other more serious chronic conditions, everything from heart issues to, in some cases, we can see, you know, amputations. Those, when it's not managed, it leads to a more serious condition. And then by definition, that is going to result in a serious, much more significant increase in overall cost. Again, cost to the insurers, cost to the patient, cost to the state. So hopefully back to answering your question, when you don't manage this, there is a there's just a plethora of undesirable consequences as a result of that. And then it becomes, you know, it becomes an issue where we have to manage those consequences, right? Either more serious health conditions could lead to hospitalization, even death in some cases, could lead to another chronic condition that is much more complicated to manage than just a diabetes. Hopefully that answers your question, ma'am.
If I could, Dr. Albanese O'Neill, go ahead.
Thank you, sir. I thank you for that question. When I was writing my remarks, I had to triage what I was going to say, so I was hoping somebody would ask a question like this. Certainly, diabetes disproportionately impacts communities of color in the state of Florida, and social determinants of health are a significant barrier to diabetes self-management. What I want to talk about is we've talked about today the acute complications of missing or rationing insulin, meaning diabetic ketoacidosis, which can happen in a matter of days. That's the that's insufficient insulin in the body of a person with diabetes, where their body's actually pH starts to drop and they need acute care in the emergency room. Hypoglycemia or low blood sugar, severe low blood sugar is also an acute complication. But we have entirely left out a discussion of the chronic complications of long-term rationing of insulin on people with diabetes. And these are amputation, so it's neuropathy. Amputations in the state of Florida are almost $100,000 per amputation. So that is a significant cost to the system. It is blindness. Diabetes is the leading cause of blindness in adults. That is a significant cost. Dialysis for kidney failure. Over $40 billion a year is spent on dialysis. Not all of it is caused by diabetes, but certainly that is a significant downstream cost that we can prevent by making insulin affordable and not having one in four people with diabetes ration their insulin at the front end. Let us protect people at the front end so they can have higher quality of life and prevent complications. Additional complications are heart failure and stroke, as were mentioned by my colleagues. So these are all really important things that we need to focus on. We should not be penny wise and pound foolish, and we really need to protect our most vulnerable Floridians. And that's why, again, I'm so pleased to be here today, to put that patient first, to put the person with diabetes first and make insulin affordable so that they can care for themselves. So I thank you for your question, and thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Doctor. I knew our time's limited, Ranking Member. I want to give what Rep. Beltran's been waiting to ask a question. So quick question, Rep. Beltran.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you all my colleagues and the panelists for robust discussion. I think it's the first time I've had a constituent, Mr. Jones, on a panel, and I think Rep. Garrison hit it right on the head. There's a market breakdown, and to that end, I want to drill down on Mr. Clark's remark, which was that they're changing and then repatenting the molecular structure of the drugs, of the insulin. And I guess if that's contributing to the problem, I'm concerned about that. What I don't understand about that, and I need to understand, is if they're changing it and they're repatenting a different molecular structure, why can't a generic manufacturer just use the original structure that's presumably long off patent by at least a lifetime, because no? Okay, well, go ahead then, answer the question, and then I'll let you.
Mr. Clark, you're recognized.
Again, I preface that with I'm not in the medical field. You know, I'm an endurance athlete. I'm a coach. That's my area of expertise. So I don't know the minutia of how this is how it works. But because they are switching such a small compound, it goes under the exact same patent. That's why it's been the same patent for 100 years now. Whatever the little tweaks they are, it's considered the original. That's my understanding.
Follow up quickly.
Just very quickly, Chairman. So what you're telling me is, in a matter of federal patent law, that if they tweak the molecular structure, it extends that original patent beyond whatever the 21 years, and I guess to date.
That
these,
would
these
be
drugs.
A good question for an attorney who's well-versed in federal patent law.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Rep. Beltran. Ranking Member Joseph, for a very quick follow-up. I did give Rep. Beltran an opportunity. I'll give you a quick opportunity, and then we have to finish. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right now, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. Can you tell us what, if any, the correlation is between diabetes or insulin and people who contract the virus, whether they had the vaccine or not?
Dr. Albanese O'Neill, would you like to respond to that?
So your question about the vaccine, I don't know much about the vaccine yet because we're still learning, so I'm going to set that aside. But what I will tell you is absolutely people with diabetes, I've actually co-authored some papers on the impact of the virus, novel coronavirus, on people with diabetes. And it has been significant, particularly people of color with type 2 diabetes. The rate of death and the rate of morbidity has been significantly higher. I'd be happy to share those manuscripts with the committee as well. But the burden has disproportionately been borne by citizens in our state who are Black, Hispanic, and Asian Pacific Islander with type 2 diabetes, and nationally. And was that the information you were looking for? Yeah, I think, again, when you couple that with job loss, and you couple that with food insecurity, and you couple that with, rent insecurity, and you couple that with a whole host of other concerns, this is something that we need to address as a state for every citizen, particularly our most vulnerable.
And Dr. Albanese, again, you mentioned having some additional information. Feel free to send that. And any panelists, too, I want to thank all of you for being with us today. If there's any additional information, please send it to us, and we can disseminate that to the committee. And we very much appreciate your time. Thank you for being here with us today to discuss this important topic. So with that, members, Vice Chair Caruso, very quick for a closing remark you'd like to make, and then we need to finish up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank the chair for bringing this workshop on insulin cost. I think it's extremely important and something that's of a concern of all of ours. And I think that demonstrates the chair's passion and concern for enhancing healthcare in the state of Florida. And I wanted to thank the chair for his leadership and your professional demeanor and through this whole process this year, and the respect you show not just for the members on the committee, but the members that present, those that are providing public testimony, and our guests, like here today. And you've been a mentor to me, and always demonstrating excellence, and also a friend. And I appreciate it, and I thank you for serving and giving us the leadership and showing us how a chair should perform. And it's been an honor to serve under you, and look forward to next year doing the same.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I'm humbled by your comments. It's been an honor to serve as your chairman. I thank all the members of the committee for your participation. We've had a lot of important issues that have come in front of us, so it's a team effort. But thank you. I'm humbled by your comments, and give the Lord the credit for any good. Rep. Caruso, thank you. I did want to mention that we did have the one appearance card was from Ron Watson from the Florida Renal Coalition. He, even though we didn't have a bill, he waved in support of us talking about the issue today. So we wanted to put that on the record. So members, thank you. This was our last authorized meeting. So as far as we know, we likely will not meet again as the Finance and Facilities Subcommittee for this year. But I want to thank you again for all of your participation and engagement on the issues. It's an honor, and look forward to the final weeks of session. So seeing no further business before the committee, we will stand adjourned. Rep. Duran moves we rise. So without objection, we'll stand adjourned. Thank you.